I never imagined that I'd be standing here. The roles should completely be reversed. My son should be burying me. My son had a smile that was worth $1 million. When he walked in the room, he lit up the room. He was a brother, a jokester. He was loved by so many. He's gonna be so missed.
As mourners gather to remember the young father who was shot and killed by a police officer during a traffic stop, lawmakers on Capitol Hill take a key step toward police reform. The question is, how soon before we see some type of legislation? Plus, health experts are expected to meet today to discuss the future of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. The recommended pause has been in effect for the past 10 days. The question is, will it soon be lifted? And the historic Mars helicopter lifts off for a higher, longer second flight. The question this morning, what's new on the red planet? It's way too early for this. And welcome to Way Too Early, the show that's going from Earth Day to Mars Day today. I am Casey Hunt on this Friday, April 23rd. It is Friday. We will start with the news. Hundreds of mourners filled a Minneapolis church yesterday for the funeral of Dante Wright, the 20-year-old black man who was fatally shot by police earlier this month during a traffic stop. During the emotional two-hour service, civil rights leaders, family members, and lawmakers all came together to pay their final respects amid calls for justice and police reform. Reverend Al Sharpton delivered the eulogy.
I was talking to one of the relatives and I said, well, what are they trying to justify? They said they saw some air fresheners in the back of his car. Well, we come today as the air fresheners for Minnesota. We trying to get the stench of police brutality out of the atmosphere. We're trying to get the stench of racism out of the atmosphere. We're trying to get the stench of racial profiling out of the atmosphere. We come to Minnesota as air fresheners because your air is too odorous for us to breathe. We can't breathe in your stinking air no more. As I talk closer to the family, they said that, well, the real reason they stopped was because his tags had expired. Well, I come to Minnesota to tell you your tags have expired. Your tags of racism has expired. It's time to renew and get some new tags. A tags of righteousness, a tags of fairness, a tags of treating everybody the same way, a tags of no justice, no peace.
And former Brooklyn Center police officer Kim Potter is charged with manslaughter in connection with Dante Wright's death. Potter has said she mistook her gun for her taser when she shot Wright. All right, let's go now to police reform. Democratic Congresswoman Karen Bass said she was waiting for the blessing of House leadership to enter into formal negotiations with Republican Senator Tim Scott. And yesterday, the Congresswoman received that word.
She has our full support. She is fair. She wants to get it done. I trust Karen Bass's knowledge of the subject, but also her knowledge of the ramifications it would have on the people that we're trying to protect, which is everybody in our country, including our law enforcement officers. So I trust her to keep on the table what can be accomplished.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who's already praised Senator Scott's efforts, will be next to sign off on formal negotiations. Congresswoman Bass says she and the South Carolina Republican have already been trading documents and exploring areas of compromise. Senator Scott said earlier this week that a deal may be reached within the next 2 weeks. A little bit of reason for optimism on the Hill. And Republican leaders have selected Senator Tim Scott to deliver the party's rebuttal to President Biden's address to the joint session of Congress next week. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said, quote, nobody is better at communicating why far-left policies fail working Americans. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy said, no member in Congress epitomizes the essence of today's Republican Party more than Senator Scott. The South Carolina Republican was appointed to the Senate by then-Governor Nikki Haley when Jim DeMint retired in 2013. He went on to win a special election in 2014 and was reelected to a full term in 2016. Senator Scott is the only Black American to have served in both chambers of Congress. Wow. He said in a statement, quote, "I look forward to having an honest conversation with the American people and sharing Republicans' optimistic vision for expanding opportunity and empowering working families." Meanwhile, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said yesterday she's offering concessions to Republicans on the makeup and subpoena power for a potential commission to investigate the January 6th attack on the Capitol. In an attempt to reach agreement with GOP leaders to create the commission, she said at her weekly news conference she's willing to make the panel evenly split between Republicans and Democrats and to issue subpoenas based on a joint decision by the chair and the vice chair or after a majority vote. She added this.
We still don't know where they will be on scope. If we can come to agreement on the first two, why would they object to the scope, which is to find the truth of what happened on January 6th. Our purpose is to find the truth for that. It's not about investigating one thing or another that they may want to draw into this, but I'm optimistic.
Spokesman for House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell say that the two have not received a proposal from Pelosi with these changes. McCarthy added at his weekly news conference that the commission is, quote, still a long way away. The original proposal for the commission would have given Democrats 7 appointments, while Republicans would have had 4. Democrats would have also had the power to issue subpoenas unilaterally. All right, joining us now, the co-founder of Punchbowl News, Anna Palmer. Anna, it's good to see you this morning. Thanks for being here. Let's start with this January 6th commission, because caught up in partisan politics, even though every member of Congress was attacked when those people breached the walls during the insurrection on January 6th. What's your sense of where Republicans are in terms of being willing to move forward with this? I mean, Speaker Pelosi clearly wanted this to be seen as some concessions to them, that she's trying to make this more bipartisan. They seem a little skeptical.
I think the speaker's trying to force their hand, right? She is making some significant concessions in terms of the size and the makeup, as you say, also the subpoena power. But we spoke to a GOP source last night who said that so far they have not heard still from the speaker, no formal proposal, more of just kind of publicly putting things out there to the press and seeing how it plays. But McCarthy and McConnell did meet and their staffs have been talking about it. So I do think there seems to be more movement on this than there was even a few weeks ago, where it seemed as if the commission might not ever get off the ground.
Yeah, Anna, do you think we're seeing any sort of legitimate change? I mean, we saw the anti-Asian hate crimes bill actually move through. We're having what seems like real conversations about police reform, the potential for a compromise, maybe some movement on this commission. Maybe not. Is there a sense that things are starting to creep back toward what some version of normal? It's been honestly a little surprising after 4 years or so of watching things kind of float out into the ether and then explode, essentially.
Yeah, we have an item actually in this morning's Punchbowl News AM newsletter about this kind of idea that bipartisanship seems to be making headway in terms of at least the Republicans and Democrats talking to each other in a way that we didn't see for the past 4 years under the Trump administration. It's not only in those areas that you mentioned, which are key in terms of police reform, but also China policy, in terms of infrastructure. You're starting to see Republicans and Democrats kind of put together different proposals. The real question is, does this actually turn into something? That we don't know. But to your point, I think is really smart, which is, yes, there is a different sense in the building that all of a sudden you have the ability for Republicans and Democrats to at least try to come together on some of these big issues.
Well, we shall see. Punchbowl News' Anna Palmer, thank you so much for being up early with us. We really appreciate it. And still ahead here, the pause in the use of Johnson & Johnson's coronavirus vaccine could soon be lifted. But has the White House already written off the shot after a string of problems? Plus, President Biden calls for new action on climate change and lays out his goals for cutting greenhouse gas emissions. We're going to have those stories and much more when we come right back.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
Welcome back. The sports world is mourning the sudden loss of a talented young basketball player. Terrence Clark, who played guard for the University of Kentucky this past season, died yesterday after a car accident in Los Angeles. Police say Clark was speeding when he ran a red light and hit a car traveling the opposite direction while he tried to make a left turn at the intersection. Clark's vehicle then ran into a pole and struck a wall, and he was later pronounced dead at the hospital. The university confirmed the news of his death last night, but it hit especially hard in his native town of Boston, which celebrated Clark as a rare, highly ranked player from the city coming out of high school. He chose Kentucky over other powerhouse basketball schools like Duke, Boston College, Texas, Kansas, and UCLA. And Clark declared for the NBA draft at the end of his lone season playing for the Wildcats. He was just 19 years old. To the Olympics now, U.S. Olympians say they won't be silenced at the Tokyo Games after the International Olympic Committee said this week that a ban on athlete protests and political messages will be upheld this summer. Gwen Berry, a 2016 U.S. Olympian and 2020 hopeful in the hammer throw, who in 2019 protested systemic racism by raising her fist on a Pan American Games podium, said the restrictions won't stop her from demonstrating in Tokyo. In a tweet yesterday, she accused the IOC of being hypocrites who continue to silence athletes for capital gain and encouraged all athletes to stand in their power and do what they feel is right. The U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee in December called on the IOC to end its ban of peaceful protest and said it wouldn't punish its own athletes for doing so. Multiple advocates for athletes' rights, including two independent international organizations and a group representing German athletes, have pledged to support and protect athletes who protest despite the rule, which prohibits raising a fist or kneeling for the national anthem. The IOC also said slogans like Black Lives Matter will not be allowed on athlete apparel at Olympic venues. However, it did approve using the words peace, respect, solidarity, inclusion, and equality on T-shirts. The IOC said it will clarify what punishments athletes could face if they do protest. The games begin on July 23rd. Meanwhile, a second pro golfer is opting out of Olympic competition. Adam Scott won't be in Tokyo this summer after his manager said the timing of the games don't fit into his schedule. The Australian also opted out of the 2016 games in Brazil. Follows the same decision last month by world number one Dustin Johnson, who said he wants to remain focused on the PGA Tour. All right, let's turn now to Major League Baseball and the start of another three-game series between NL West heavyweights in Southern California. Let's pick it up in the bottom of the eighth. The Dodgers trailing the Padres by a run with the bases loaded.
And this is to second. Eats up Cronenworth to second for one. On to first. They got him. Nicely done.
Wow, that dazzling double play off a heartache grounder to second base gets San Diego out of the jam. They hang on to beat Los Angeles 3-2. Very nice. And finally, we've got another tragedy involving snacks in the stands, this time in Cincinnati, where one fan not only lost a souvenir for his son, but also his plate of nachos and a shoe while taking a tumble. Ooh, ouch. Going after a home run ball hitting the seats in center field. It's not all bad, though. The wife of Reds relief pitcher Lucas Sims connected with the so-called Nacho Man through Twitter and promised an autographed baseball as well as some free pizza in exchange for the lost nachos. Hope everyone is doing all right after that incident. All right, time now for the weather. Let's go to meteorologist Bill Cairns for a check on the forecast. Bill, please tell me it's going to get warmer.
It'll get warmer, but it may also get wetter for you too, Casey. So let's get into this next big storm that's coming. We're going to watch a severe weather threat beginning later today. It's going to continue into Saturday and then a soaking rain up the East Coast on Sunday. So here's today's threat area. If you live in areas that are in the bright orange color there, the Shreveport, Alexandria, Lake Charles, that's the area that could even deal with some tornadoes. And we expect a lot of large hail. You'll probably see pictures of it all over social media later on today. Watch out Dallas and also Waco to Austin and then heading towards Houston. And then on Saturday, our severe weather threat and large hail threat shifts to the southeast, including Birmingham, Montgomery, all over the Florida Panhandle, Atlanta, and eventually a wind damage threat through areas of South Carolina and even a portion there of North Carolina. So here's today's forecast. It's a cold morning on the eastern seaboard, but this afternoon it warms up nicely into the 60s, even for Boston, mid-60s in D.C. Then the weekend forecast, there's the severe weather threat in the southeast Saturday, kind of a gloomy, rainy day in the Ohio Valley. That rain will be in the northeast on Sunday, especially the first half of the day. Casey, you may get lucky with a little better weather come Sunday afternoon, Sunday afternoon. So Sunday morning, Casey, that's your indoor time. Get all your chores done then.
Good to know. All right, Bill Cairns, have a wonderful weekend. Thank you so much. We'll see you on Monday. And still ahead here, jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny is weighing in on the wave of arrests this week after thousands of protesters hit the streets calling for his freedom. We'll be back in just a moment.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win.
Welcome back. President Biden yesterday made a bold pledge to cut carbon emissions by half in just 9 years, by 2030.
When people talk about climate, I think jobs. That's why I've proposed a huge investment in American infrastructure and American innovation. By maintaining those investments and putting these people to work, the United States sets out on the road to cut greenhouse gases in half by the end of this decade. We really have no choice. We have to get this done.
That pledge, part of the administration's new commitment to the Paris Climate Agreement, was made during a virtual two-day climate summit in an effort to urge global cooperation on climate change. Let's go now to Russia, where opposition leader Alexei Navalny says he's filled with pride and hope after learning about the protests demanding his freedom this week. In an Instagram post, the imprisoned Navalny called his supporters the salvation of Russia for protesting across the country on Wednesday. The protests seem to have had an impact, according to a top aide for Navalny. He says as soon as they were announced, the Putin critic was moved from a prison hospital to a civilian hospital. Navalny has seen his health decline amid a four-week hunger strike over lack of proper medical care. Now that he's getting public medical help, his doctors are urging him to end the strike immediately. Meanwhile, Russia has ordered its troops to withdraw from the Ukraine border after recent military activity sparked concerns that came all the way to Washington. Kremlin officials say troops will return to their permanent bases by May 1st, although some weapons and armored vehicles will stay. This comes after a massive military buildup in recent weeks and the imposing of new Russian sanctions by President Biden. Russian President Vladimir Putin seemed to respond to the new sanctions Wednesday, issuing a warning about crossing Russia's red line during his annual State of the Nation address. All right, still ahead here. Republicans unveil their counterproposal to President Biden's infrastructure plan. But what do Democrats in the White House think? Former GOP Congresswoman Barbara Comstock will join me for that discussion. But before we go to break, we want to know, as always, why are you awake? Email us your reasons for being up and watching to waytooearly at MSNBC.com or drop me a tweet at Casey. Use the hashtag waytooearly and we'll read our favorite answers coming up later on in the show. to Way Too Early. It is just before 5:30 here on the East Coast, 2:30 out west. I'm Casey Hunt. Federal health authorities are scheduled to meet today to decide whether to resume the use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine after finding only a limited number of additional cases of a rare blood clotting disorder among recipients. The CDC advisory group is leaning toward lifting the pause, and use could start as early as this weekend. Resuming use of the vaccine could look similar to the European Union's continued rollout, which earlier this week included no restrictions, but a warning citing that the benefits outweighed the risk. Use of the vaccine was initially halted after six women out of nearly 7 million vaccine recipients developed blood clots. Two government officials tell The Washington Post that the current stance could be affected if a flood of blood clot reports come in, but that seems unlikely. And despite the continuation in this pause of the use of the J&J vaccine, the White House seems to have written off the pharmaceutical company's shot. Sources tell Politico that privately, senior health officials have grown frustrated with the company's production issues and have concluded that it can't be counted on until it gets the go-ahead from regulators to resume giving shots. The company has faced several setbacks, including a contractor mix-up that ruined 15 million doses, revealing serious safety and hygiene concerns, as well as, of course, the rare blood clot disorder. According to two people with direct knowledge of the situation, if testing of the vaccine reveals more contamination, it could take J&J 4 months to replace doses at other facilities. All right, joining us now, Washington correspondent for The New York Times, Cheryl Stolberg. Cheryl, good morning. Thank you so much for getting up early to be with us. You're looking at vaccine hesitancy and how that could potentially be the problem that we're facing coming up here next. This J&J news obviously plays into that. What have you been focusing on here?
So I've been focusing on this next phase of the vaccine campaign. You know, roughly half the nation's adults have had their first dose of coronavirus vaccine. And as my sources are telling me, the low-hanging fruit has been picked. And officials are going to have to figure out how are they going to get those rest of the Americans to take the vaccine. It's going to take a lot of hard work. It's going to be kind of like a ground game, like Election Day, where you're going to see people, even in some neighborhoods, going door to door, health officials in underserved neighborhoods, asking people, have you been vaccinated? Are you willing to be vaccinated?
So how does the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, I mean, part of the reason why this is so concerning and part of why that report that the White House has got all these doubts about it is so troublesome is that this is a shot that's easier to use in those kinds of situations because it's one and done. You don't have to get those people to come back anywhere. You don't have to do a follow-up appointment. You can store it at these lower temperatures. I mean, how does what's happening with J&J play into this next phase of our vaccine rollout?
So you're absolutely right. It's going to make it a lot harder. I talked to the health commissioner in Maine earlier this week. He said that the absence of the J&J vaccine during this pause is depressing their vaccination numbers. This is the vaccine that estates were going to use to maybe reach homeless people or people in prison. That one and done is really attractive. Some people really like the idea of one and done, people who don't really like to take shots. And Casey, we also have to remember that this is the vaccine that was going to go to the world. And that is super important because it's inexpensive, it's easy to administer. And if everybody isn't vaccinated around the world, it's like nobody is vaccinated.
Yeah, and that's we've clearly seen that sort of explode in other places. India is one concerning area, and none of us, of course, as you point out, are safe if we can't figure out how to wipe this out across the globe. The New York Times, Cheryl Stolberg, thank you very much for getting up early with us. We really appreciate you being here. Hope to see you again soon. And still ahead here, NASA reaches new heights on Mars ahead of a totally different mission to the International Space Station this morning. Way Too Early, back in just a moment. All right, time now for something totally different. You can only get better by practicing, and that is exactly what the Mars Ingenuity helicopter is doing. Yesterday, it took the red planet's skies for a second time, flying for 52 seconds and going higher than it did in its first flight. NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab tweeted, "Go big or go home." The Mars helicopter successfully completed its second flight, capturing this image with its black and white navigation camera. It also reached new milestones of a higher altitude, a longer hover, and lateral flying. It comes as an expected SpaceX launch just a short time from now will send astronauts to relieve the crew at the International Space Station. I am so excited about this. Love that it is happening here on Way Too Early. There's also this, unrelated. Maya Rudolph wants to get her ragtag bridesmaids back together. In an interview with Entertainment Tonight, the SNL alum said she'd be down for a Bridesmaids movie sequel, although she joked it would have to be called, quote, Old Ladies. Looking back at the iconic comedy, which turns 10 next week, wow, Rudolph shared that her favorite scene to film was the elaborate Paris-themed bridal shower in which she and Kristen Wiig's character get into a fight. Fans have been vying for a Bridesmaids reunion for years now, but the film's director has said in the past, it's unlikely. I would be first in line to see a reunion of this crew. All right, still ahead here. Former Republican Congresswoman Barbara Comstock is our guest. Don't go anywhere. Way Too Early. Coming right back. Welcome back. The latest numbers from the Labor Department show the U.S. jobs market recovery accelerated its pace last week. Well below estimates, first-time claims for unemployment insurance marked a new low for the pandemic era, totaling 547,000. Still, about 8 million fewer Americans are at work than were at work before the pandemic. And President Biden is set to unveil a new $1.5 trillion family recovery bill, according to two sources familiar with the discussions. The White House says the president will outline his new American Families Plan during a speech to Congress on Wednesday. The bill will focus on expanding child care, paid leave after COVID-19 vaccinations, universal pre-K, and extending the child tax credit. Sources say the White House is considering tax hikes on the wealthiest Americans to help pay for the plan. Republicans, meanwhile, have a $568 billion counterproposal for an infrastructure package, one that Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia calls, quote, calls the, quote, most robust plan we've ever put forward as Republicans. NBC News reports it calls for $299 billion for roads and bridges, more than $60 billion for both broadband infrastructure and public transit systems, $35 billion for drinking and wastewater, and $44 billion for airports, as well as $20 billion for rail systems. It also sets aside a collective $45 billion for ports, water storage, and safety items. The plan calls for the tax cuts passed under former President Donald Trump to be kept intact and to repurpose unspent federal funding passed as part of COVID-19 relief packages for infrastructure spending. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said aides plan to look at the details of the proposal and discuss it with congressional staff in the coming days. All right, joining us now, former Republican Congresswoman Barbara Comstock of Virginia. Congresswoman, thank you so much for getting up early to be with us. And as someone who has experience in it, particularly a swing district in Virginia, you have seen how the Republican Party and the political terrain has changed back and forth over the last couple of years. What do you make of this infrastructure proposal that the Biden team has put forward and the fact that Republicans clearly felt like they needed to at least be on the record as saying, actually, we have a plan. We're not just saying no.
Well, I think that's one area where you've usually been able to have some bipartisan agreement. And so when you have somebody like Shelley Moore Capito out there, who's, you know, I think a great leader and, you know, strong woman out there, I think there's some hope for some compromise, because infrastructure things aren't red or blue. Every district in the country has some challenge, whether it's bridges or roads or transit. So this is usually an area where people have been able to come together. Always a challenge to figure out how to pay for it, but it usually can get cobbled together because it's, you know, it's certainly needed.
For sure. And so part of why I wanted to have you on this morning is because I know you spoke with the New York Times Magazine for a piece about your former colleague, Liz Cheney. And that piece details how several male GOP lawmakers harshly criticized Cheney during a conference meeting over her decision to vote to impeach President Trump. Several of these comments were, I'm just going to go ahead and say that they were decidedly sexist, and they sparked outrage among Republican women in Washington. One such comment was of a particular focus. Pennsylvania Congressman Mike Kelly reportedly said, quote, "You look up into the stands and you see your girlfriend on the opposition side. That's one hell of a tough thing to swallow." According to the Times, a female colleague yelled in response, "She's not your girlfriend." But the comment quickly spread among female GOP circles. Other comments include Congressman Ralph Norman insisting that Cheney has a, quote, defiant attitude, and Congressman John Rutherford chastising Cheney for not being a, quote, team player. The conference meeting went so far as to have several members requesting Cheney apologize, to which the congresswoman responded, "I cannot do that." There was also a quote from Jeff Duncan that stuck out to me where he said that she did not display humility. Take us behind the scenes here. What do you make of all these comments, the things people have had to say about Liz Cheney after she stood up and did, quite frankly, what so many of them were unwilling to do, which is to criticize and take the criticism from former President Trump?
Well, first of all, I was so proud of my friend Liz Cheney when she did stand up, even before January 6th, in saying, you know, in attacking the lies about the election. And then, of course, after in supporting impeachment, which I did also, and also other, you know, brave colleagues who did that and obviously incur the wrath of Donald Trump. But I would like to point out that those men that you quoted, and I did hear about that in real time, were in the minority. And people like Matt Gaetz and those other people you quoted who were attacking Liz ended up losing very badly that day. They had gone into that vote claiming they had a majority of members, and Liz won strongly with two-thirds approval. So I think they get a lot more attention than they should because they represent a minority within the party. Unfortunately, they're a loud and misogynistic minority, and they are an embarrassment to the party, as are some of the women that they have promoted, like Marjorie Greene, who I serve on two Republican women boards to get women elected. We decidedly didn't endorse her and opposed her. So this is a minority of Republicans, but it is disturbing. And that's why I spoke out both at the time and since, because I think people like Liz Cheney, you know, and Adam Kinzinger, Jamie Herrera Butler, those are the people who represent the future of the party. And I do think this Trump cult will die out.
All right. Former Congresswoman Barbara Comstock, thanks very much for being here. We really appreciate your perspective. We'd love to have you back down the line. Thank you.
Thank you.
And this is very exciting. I'm thrilled to be able to cover this here on Way Too Early. Breaking news from Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral, Florida. The Elon Musk-owned SpaceX is launching four astronauts to the International Space Station right now. Two Americans, Shane Kimbrough and Megan MacArthur, one Japanese astronaut, one French astronaut also aboard. Liftoff is scheduled for 5:49. That is 3 minutes from now in this good weather. This is the third ever crewed flight for SpaceX and the second flight for the Crew Dragon capsule. The journey is expected to take a day with astronauts docking at the space station early tomorrow morning. And joining us now is NBC News correspondent Tom Costello, who covers aviation for us. Tom, you cover so many things for us. I've always been so jealous that you cover space launches. It's possible I was awarded the the Right Stuff Award at Space Camp. I was the most enthusiastic camper. So what do we know about this launch? And what have you seen since you've been down there?
This is yet again another spectacular launch we expect coming up at 5:49 Eastern time. And you'll forgive me, I'm also listening to Mission Control here on a speaker to make sure that we're not missing anything. They have now loaded the fuel. You can see that they have retracted, or are about to retract, I should say, the arm out to the Dragon space capsule. And as you mentioned, four astronauts on board. two Americans, a European astronaut. By the way, the first time a European astronaut has taken off from U.S. soil in 10 years, and then a Japanese astronaut. All of them are veterans. But interestingly, in the case of Megan MacArthur, she is the pilot on board, not the commander, but the pilot. Her husband is Bob Behnken. He was in the first SpaceX launch a year ago. And guess what? She is sitting in the exact same seat in the exact same space capsule, because SpaceX is reusing space capsules as well as rockets. And that is all part of the SpaceX mode, as you know. They're trying to reuse the technology because it makes it all much more cost effective. So she is about to ride in the exact seat her husband was in a year ago. She talked to us about experiencing watching from the ground a year ago with her son and holding her heart as she watched a SpaceX rocket with Bob Behnken going up in May of last year. She said, I wasn't thinking about myself. I was thinking about him and thinking, please, 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 please make it all work well. Now the roles reverse. Bob Behnken will be on the ground and she is about to take off.
Seven.
We are in the final countdown. Here we go.
Four.
Let's listen to the countdown.
Two. One. Zero. Mission. And liftoff. Godspeed, Endeavour and crew two.
Copy, one alpha.
Endeavour launches once again. Four astronauts from three countries on crew two, now making their way to the one and only International Space Station. Vehicle is pitching downrange. Nine Merlin engines on the first stage providing 1.7 million pounds of thrust. Hearing good calls on first stage performance so far.
We are T plus 30 seconds into the second rotational crew mission on board Dragon and Falcon 9. Falcon 9 will be throttling down the nine Merlin engines shortly here in preparation for maximum dynamic pressure. And there's that call out for the throttle down. Maximum dynamic pressure, max Q, is the largest structural load that the vehicle sees throughout ascent. So throttling down does help us pass.
Supersonic.
Throttling down helps us pass through this period, which should be coming here shortly.
Max Q.
There's that call out that we have just passed through max Q.
Stage one, throttle up.
And
one Bravo.
Copy, one Bravo.
All right, one Bravo is the second abort mode on the first stage. First stage continues to fire for 2 minutes, 35 seconds, 1.5 minutes into today's flight. Falcon 9 now traveling at more than 1,500 miles an hour.
What are we seeing here?
This is still a critical moment of flight here. Until they are actually inserted into the orbit, that should happen at 5:57 a.m., we're still very much in a wait-and-see mode, and we want to watch closely for main engine cutoff.
About 30 more seconds of the first stage firing to bring our four astronauts into orbit.
Now from here, coming up in about 20-some seconds, we're going to have three major milestones. We'll have shutdown of the nine Merlin engines. We're beginning to throttle them down. We will then get stage separation.
Tom, we're looking.
And then we will get ignition.
Are we looking at a camera that's on the rocket?
Propel Dragon and the Falcon 9 second stage into orbit.
Yeah, you've got multiple cameras there, Casey, coming from the rocket, looking as we look now for main engine cutoff on the first stage. It will drop away, and that's going to be a critical point here.
Acquisition signal.
There it goes. Cheering.
And we have ignition of the second stage. You see the green flash of that T-TEB fluid. The expansion nozzle on the second stage Merlin vacuum glowing that bright red that we like to see. Good performance on the second stage so far.
And on the left side of your screen, we saw the exhaust of the second stage engine streaming past the first stage as the grid fins are coming out. We also briefly had a view of the lights of Central Florida in the background. Currently, the first stage.
Hey, Tom, who are we listening to here? Is this the SpaceX team that's narrating this for us?
Reach a peak height and then begin to descend.
Yeah, you're listening to the SpaceX and NASA mission control that are giving us the voice of talking us through everything that's happening here. They will now hit the orbit insertion. In other words, they will insert into orbit at 5:57 a.m. Eastern time. At 5:58:32, that incredible moment we have been known to watch SpaceX for as they land. And they land the rocket back on the drone ship out in the Atlantic Ocean, something that only SpaceX has pulled off so far. They are now well on their way into space safely, 17,000 miles per hour. These engines generating 1.7 million pounds of thrust. The Merlin engines using liquid oxygen and kerosene. And again, a unique SpaceX mixture for their rockets.
The astronauts into orbit. We'll wait for a cue for good orbital insertion after that. Meanwhile, we'll be hearing check-ins on the vehicle's trajectory and performance, as well as check-ins with some of the ground stations as it passes over. Throughout the 6 minutes of the second stage firing.
Now, Casey, interestingly here, what's important to note is as they fly up the east coast of the United States, there are multiple abort zones, if you will. If they had to abort, they would abort in various abort zones. And those are called nominal trajectory. That means everything's going well. The stage 2A would be an abort stage 2A, a particular location up the east coast they could abort to.
Acquisition of signal.
All the way up to abort echo. But at this point, everything is going exactly as planned.
Stage telemetry signal. Meanwhile, the first stage.
Love to see it.
Has reached apogee and it's now beginning to descend from a height. It's currently about 167 kilometers up. And in a few minutes, we will get the entry burn of the second stage, of the first stage.
So,
perfect.
Tom, he's saying their entry burn of the first stage, that's the rocket that's going to land back on that carrier that you were mentioning?
Exactly. You've got good ears there, Casey. That's exactly right. The first stage is going to come back down and land in the Atlantic Ocean on a drone ship. That is, as we've said, the signature move that SpaceX invented and has perfected. 5:58 a.m., 5:58:32 was when that should land on the drone ship. Keeping in mind that they are reusing a rocket already on this mission and a space capsule already. So the whole mode, the whole mission, the whole way of working at SpaceX is to reuse these parts, and they are already now reusing them on this mission.
124 miles.
It's remarkable. And Tom, they are heading for the International Space Station. Can you walk us through the overall profile of this mission, what they're going up there to accomplish?
I will. And let's just keep our eyes on this because I think we're all going to want to watch that landing on the drone ship. They're going to dock at the International Space Station tomorrow morning at about 5:10 a.m. Interestingly here, that will bring to 11 the number of people on the space station right now. That's the most that have been on station for years. Nominal trajectory. That's all great. Now, here's the problem. It's a minor complication. They've got three toilets now for all 11 astronauts. They don't have enough beds. So as a result, two astronauts and maybe three are going to it's a complication. So two astronauts, maybe three, will have to literally get into a sleeping bag and tether themselves to a wall for just about a week or so until four astronauts that arrived last November, until they come down probably next week. We're expecting them to re-enter next Wednesday. So it's going to be a little crowded up there. The good news is they did just add that third toilet. So they've got three commodes for 11 people, not quite enough beds. But as the NASA chief said to me yesterday, we've got another dimension here, and that is you can float anywhere on the station.
I was going to say, you don't have to worry about having a comfy mattress if you're just hanging out in zero gravity. That's amazing. So,
you know,
Tom,
a couple of days ago. Sorry.
Continuing to look good on the first stage. I talked
to an astronaut a couple of days ago who said it was the best sleep she ever had. Wow, she said being literally floating in space, I thought maybe it would be uncomfortable because you're not literally putting your head down. She said it was the best sleep she's ever had. She loved it.
It's just amazing. I am so in awe of the people who have learned how to do this, had a chance to do this, put everything on the line for it, to give us a chance to explore all of this. Tom, we're starting to see the picture on the left side of our screens change a little bit. Is that where we're going to see this rocket drop back into the atmosphere, or what are we looking at over there? Yeah, we just lost that feed.
I believe so, but we don't control that feed. It's going to come back. Don't worry. They've got multiple cameras here. So eventually we should see the first stage landing out on that drone ship out there in the Atlantic Ocean. Launch escape system disarmed. That's all good news. Everything.
Dragon SpaceX.
Everything is working just as planned. And nominal orbit insertion. That means they have now hit the orbit 17,000 miles per hour. That's perfect. That's exactly what they wanted to accomplish. And you've got the cheers from SpaceX Mission Control. And I think we're about to get the landing coming up.
Of course, I still love you, loss of signal. All right, Tom Costello, thank you so much. That was so much fun. Please don't go anywhere because Morning Joe wants to keep talking to you about this.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.